I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. And this week, from Cuba, we call open source an American conversation with global attitude. This one is about Havana, port and capital, the most alluring wreck of all the world's great cities, many people feel. It's spectacularly dilapidated, sad, spirited, sort of fairy godmother with warts and missing teeth. Salty, a city famous for its 50s Studebakers and Pontiacs, and with the feel of North America in the 50s still pulsing, TV baseball without commercials, and stadium baseball of big league skill under yellow lights with exquisite cigar smoke in the December night air. Our 40-minute conversation here is with the world-traveled Cuban architect Mario Coyola. And among the questions are, how long can this go on, this glamour of decay? And what if the stagnation of Havana proves in the long run to have been a blessing, if and when Cuba and Havana take their place back as the hinge of culture and commerce between Anglo-North and Latin South America? Mario Coyola, it's wonderful to see you in Havana. Nobody knows the design, the architecture, the building of this city better than you. Can you explain this fabulous charm of a crumbling city?
Well, first of all, thanks for those nice words, which I don't actually deserve. Maybe one of the glamorous things about Havana is precisely that crumbling combined with the fact that it has been preserved. So it's a very unusual and also unstable condition. It's a very alive city, but people are having a very hard life. It's a very beautiful city that has layers of very interesting, good architecture from different periods of its history. And on the other hand, we are not producing right now the same kind of quality in contemporary architecture, which is a big problem. We should produce an architecture that would pay homage to the kind of architecture our ancestors have produced before. And I'm not talking about great individual pieces of architecture, work of geniuses, but I mean the average level, having a high average level is what actually makes a city. And this is what actually made Havana in the past. A very good average quality of architecture, not only from the upper classes, but from lower middle and even working class city was also nicely conceived and designed. And of course, there was, as in any city, pockets of poverty within the city, and also at the periphery. But one thing I always try to point out is that one difference that about Havana compared to most other Latin American cities is that this was a lower middle-class city. So in many other cities, 60 years ago, Latin American cities, you could find a big gap between the very wealthy and the very poor. And that was not the case in Havana, at least of the city. The very poor were in the countryside and were seasonal workers who could only work 3-4 months a year and starved the rest of the year. But within the city, anybody with a regular salary could make a living, more or less, decent living, and you couldn't see poverty. Also because of the fact that poverty was disguised behind classical facades. So slums and tenements were within the central city were disguised. You walk by the sidewalk, and if you didn't come in, you would never see the poverty. Poverty was inside. And, well, this was one specific thing about Havana. And I think also a very important thing is that the city grew by addition without destructing, but without eating itself, as it happened in many other cities. We were spurred from the overdevelopment of the 50s, and actually in the 50s already this had started. And in my opinion, 10, 15 years later, we would have destroyed a lot of Havana if the revolution would not have happened, because revolution shifted its emphasis from Havana to the rest of the country. And in doing this, it created a big problem because of the lack of maintenance, which is still a big problem right now. But on the other hand, it improved the living condition in the rest of the country, and it stopped migrants from coming into Havana from the countryside and smaller cities, and also it prevented us to destroy the city, because in the 50s and early 60s, we all, I mean the architects and planners, we were all following the same mentality of modern architecture, meaning old was bad, new was good,
And tear it down
and replace it for new buildings. And so Havana was spurred from us. And in that sense.
Well, you know, it can be a great blessing. I mean, I think of the mill cities in New England. Lowell, for a great example, couldn't afford to tear their mills down. And now they've got them reused as housing.
Oh, yes.
This is a common thing in the States.
Because industrialization started in New England. And also ended earlier.
Yes.
And now you have a very nice heritage of beautiful brick buildings.
But if they'd had a chance, they would have knocked them all down.
Yes. Well, it's always a matter of being wealthy at some point and then suddenly freezing into a certain kind of poverty or stagnation. And then that's the way things are preserved. And then it comes a moment when you realize you have a heritage, a very valuable heritage, not only in cultural terms, but also is part of an economic heritage, because it's valuable. It adds value to the surroundings.
Yeah. A friend of yours, who's also a friend of mine, says Havana is one of those rare world cities today that it does not have shanty towns and it does not have skyscrapers.
Well, we have shanties, too many, but not as large as in other countries. I remember in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, there is a shanty town. I once was taken by some friends over there, and after almost 2 hours, we turned back, and we were still halfway to see the rest of the shanty. It was bigger than the rest of the city, actually. The whole city. And we have shanty towns, but smaller. And they have grown in the last 15, 20 years because of the crisis after the fall of the Soviet Union. So the fact is that a lot of people have resorted to self-help housing, because the supply of housing through social housing through the government has been not enough to meet the needs of the people. And this is now very obvious when you see the results of the three past hurricanes that destroyed a lot of dwellings in Cuba. Most of those dwellings, practically all of them, were shacks. And they couldn't resist the winds of a hurricane.
Mario Curiola, I'm wondering, what does an architect's eye see in these old streets of Havana in which the buildings are seen to be coming apart and yet there's a great human vitality of family life, great walking spaces? In Robert Polidoro's photographs or anybody's...
Well, Polidori likes to picture ruins.
Well, but he makes them irresistible.
He makes them very, very attractive.
That's my question.
What is the secret of a city that is in terrible repair and yet hugely alluring in photographs and walking?
Yeah, well, it's a nice question. I think we have a very nice setting by the sea. The whole waterfront, especially the Malecón, is great. It has the shape of an S. So from any point, you always see at the same time the sea and the city. It's great. It's very vivid.
Anything like it in the world?
It's difficult to tell, but there's a smaller version in Cádiz, but I think ours is much more, it's bigger and more visually strong than the one in Cádiz. And of course, there are also, it's funny, but New York City, for instance, Manhattan doesn't have a nice waterfront. It's an island, and it should have a nice waterfront.
It has freeways.
I'm sorry?
Well, it has freeways.
Yes, it's blocked. And you know what? Well, you're from Boston. You know the Big Dig is supposed to give access to the citizens, again, just up to the waterfront by digging and putting underground all those highways. And we are still lucky because the city has not been divided by those huge roads or overpasses. It seems that in the big Asian cities, especially in China, they are repeating the same mistakes as in Western countries 40, 50 years ago.
The big mistakes, which ones?
First of all, becoming too big. Second, by destroying the fabric of the existing city and replacing it by this shapeless, anodyne buildings that look all the same, and also destroying the continuity of the fabric of the city by placing these huge highways that separate the city one part from the other, and it's very difficult to reunite them again in the future. So there are many things we should learn from mistakes other cities have made before, and this is the good thing about stagnation. But on the other hand, as I said at the beginning of this talk, this cannot go on forever.
I'm wondering, Havana hangs on. How long, and who's going to intervene?
Well, I don't know exactly. First of all, more and more I realize that this was a very well-built city because it has been able to withstand neglect for 50, 60, 70 years. Because there is a common idea that neglect started with the revolution, and actually the central city was neglected even decades before the revolution. But the thing is that there was small owners provided for the maintenance of their houses, or landowners, landlords, because it was a mean of income for them. And when the government took control of every dwelling in the country, it also took the task, the burden of the maintenance, and it proved to be impossible. So maintenance fell behind the needs, and also, on the other hand, the overcrowding increased. And this was also combined with the persistence and even the growth of urban marginality, combined with rural immigrants who don't care about the city because they were not born here. And so it's a very special combination of physical decay and a social erosion.
Hmm.
And so sometimes I say that the buildings, for instance, the buildings in the front line of the Malecón in central Havana, they are submitted to a double aggression. From the outside is the salt spray from the sea, always eroding and corroding the walls. And then from the inside, by overcrowding and bad living habits. So the walls are strong, but not that strong.
Here in the Vedado, we see, you know, in any block there will be a house missing, like a tooth gone.
Mm-hmm.
So what needs to be done, and what's the chance that it will be done?
Well, I think we need to face these problems with a very open mind. There's no one single solution to big problems, and housing is a very big problem in every country. So we need to use any possible ways to face these needs. And I think there can be, for instance, why we have cooperatives in the countryside, rural cooperatives. Why not having urban cooperatives as well?
To do what?
To do the repairing and maintenance of the buildings, or just to come together, a group of people, and build, instead of a single house, single story dwelling, build a three-story apartment building by their own means, not depending on the government. Maybe getting some support from the government as technical advice and soft loans and building materials at regular prices, not right now prices even for maintenance, where the prices of materials is enormous. People can't handle that. And on the other hand, maybe I would say that most of the workers who work for the Ministry of Construction in building state building enterprises could become small cooperatives of workers, and it would make more sense and save money, because now, of course, there are big works like dams and highways and bridges and things like that, power stations and things like that, that must be built by state enterprises. But in the case of housing, a lot of housing can be done by cooperatives or small groups of workers, and so this should be used. The fact is, it has been made illegally or without acknowledgement from the government. But instead of looking the other way, we should, I think the government should pay attention and try to use this energy, this potential, in the right way and make it legal, first of all. Because what I am really, and this is very sad, what I am really realizing now is that most of the people are doing illegal things all the time.
Mm.
And this is very bad, because it creates a moral weakening of the population. So we are in the danger of becoming a well-instructed country of with a lot of people who are committing small crimes all the time.
Just living.
Yes, in order to make a living. And this has been acknowledged by our leaders recently, especially Raul Castro, for the first time when he acknowledged last year that salaries are not enough to make a living. And this is the real reason why people steal or cheat or do all the kind of things they do, or go black market or whatever.
Well, a lot of the economy in Cuba apparently is underground.
It is, and it's a very sad thing, because people are getting used to that. And this is destroying the most important resource this country has, which is people. We have a very skilled, educated, well, instructed population. I should not say educated, because sometimes you find that professional with a college degree is less educated than 50 years ago a peasant, which was illiterate. But anyway,
that's true. That's true many places.
I know it's happening all around the world, and And then the thing is how to use this skilled population in a way that the majority of people would be able to solve their own problems, and in order to also make cities to pay for themselves. It's a very complicated thing. And from my point of view, which is not, I'm not an economist, I'm not a social scientist, but the most important thing is to create the way so the city could be able to pay for itself and for the people to be able to pay for themselves instead of depending on a benevolent government which is broke.
Hmm.
We have the possibility of moving past an economy that depends on factories, on making things, and filling the city with smoke from the stacks of the factories, to a more contemporary economy based on knowledge and based on entertainment and tourism, partially, because too much tourism can also be dangerous, and on design and information, a lot of things that can be made because we have the population to do that, as opposed to many other Latin American countries which have a big gap between an elite which is educated and a majority of people who can even speak Spanish, like in many Latin American countries.
Hmm. Havana, for all the disrepair, is a beloved city in all the world. And I wonder what you think as a designer and an architect. What can Havana teach the world?
I think one of the most interesting things of the Havana, but also in many other cities, is the combination of variety and unity. So you achieved unity by regulations, urban layout, and then regulations, setbacks, things like that. And variety came just normally because of buildings were made by different people in different periods, different architects, different styles. So it's a very nice combination of variety and unity, which is the basic thing for harmony. For many centuries, Cuba, and especially Havana, was a springboard for Spain to conquer and plunder America, Central and South America. But later, it was also a springboard for the U.S. to go into the same Latin America. So we have to find a niche for Cuba. What would be our role? Sometimes I think in 1958... Havana was already a great city,
yes,
a great world city, and Miami was a sleepy town of retirees. And now Miami is still an ugly city. It's a big, ugly city, but, well, except for some few nice places, of course, but it's very alive economically. I don't know if the money comes from the drug traffic it took away part of the role that belonged to Havana as a pivot between North and South America. I think we need to face this, and in any way I figure about the future, I think more and more it all depends on the kind of relations Cuba will have with the United States.
Mm.
And we need to accept each other and also accept differences. Be more tolerant. That's my opinion.
Is that a government opinion too, would you say?
No, I don't think so. I think there are too many resentments from both sides. Maybe not so much from the American side, because as a matter of fact, I don't think Cuba is such a big deal for the U.S. government. It's a big deal for in order to win Florida because of the votes of hardline Cuban Americans. But hardline Cuban Americans are dying, and their children don't think the same way. So I'm sure in the very short future, things will change. But then we will have to face another kind of aggression. Right now, our problem is we don't have any money. And the next problem would be still having nothing or very little money, and on the other hand, having too much money coming in too quickly. And this could be even worse than no money at all.
Really?
Yes, because we can turn Havana into Las Vegas or anything else, or Tijuana, I don't know. We would have the city filled with McDonald's and Pizza Huts and Kentucky Fried Chickens. And it's also, it's even happening in countries, in European countries, that have a very strong culture and tradition. 30 years ago, you wouldn't find a Spaniard drinking Coca-Cola. They would drink nice red wine, which is, by the way, very good for the heart. And now they're getting fat on McDonald's and Coca-Colas. And
you don't you don't think Starbucks could make Cuban coffee?
I think we can have much better coffee than Starbucks.
Well, what's the path then between turning Havana into Club Med with Starbucks and McDonald's and just quietly rotting away?
I think the answer is a little of everything. I think a little of tourism is not bad, but depending on tourism as the major source of income for any country is very dangerous. And depending on one single source of income is very dangerous. It turns you very vulnerable to any changes. So we should try to have a diversity of options. And this is also what happens with foreign investors. When we are having five or six strong foreign investors trying to make horrible big hotels and spoiling beautiful beaches in Cuba, it's very difficult for the government to say no. I don't want this project because it's ugly, because you have five and you lose one, it's a very sensible loss. But if you could have tens of thousands of investors, you could afford to say no to a bad project. But then again, this is the results of too much centralization. This is something I have been complaining for a long time. When a government official, a very high-level government official, can only deal with five or six investors at the same time, they are not prepared to deal with tens of thousands. And yet, this would be the best thing for the city instead of a few very big investors.
You mean 10,000 investors in the form of mortgage holders, small developers, individual houses?
Yes.
Who are the 10,000 investors you're talking about? Are they city residents?
No, there would be foreign investors making, instead of big hotels, small hotels or hostels or restaurants.
I see.
Or small or stores, not the big firms. I would hate to have Costco's, even if it's very nice to buy at a low price. But this will create a kind of city that would be destroying the fabric of the existing city. It's already happening. We already have this happening in the west part of Havana, around the Monte Barreto area, the Miramar Trade Center. That's exactly the kind of development I think it's wrong, because it's all based on one kind of currency, hard currency, for one kind of people, It's segregated from the city. It makes people. It's meant for cars. You need large parking spaces, and the only thing missing is a fence around with a guard in the door. I think this is exactly what we don't need. We need to spend part of that money in the existing city and make it alive again. Galliano Street was a beautiful commercial street. People used to walk just looking at the windows and looking at this place. I'm talking about the 1950s. Now it's dead, completely dead. It's ugly. A lot of small stores have been turned into makeshift dwellings. And this is an irony, a lot of former mansions in Vedado and Miramar have been turned into offices or stores. So you have stores turned into makeshift dwellings, and you have dwellings turned into makeshift stores. Mm. And this is, it happened to other cities in the past, in the world, I mean. But there are also cities that have former city centers becoming alive again. And then how can we do that without gentrifying the old center? Or maybe we would need only a small amount of gentrification to put a little economic life into that part of the city. I don't know.
Havana Vieja is a beautiful, fashionable, interesting place. Central Havana is potentially a hugely attractive place. How would you do it without driving good poor people out of there?
Well, there are people who would, I think there are places in Central Havana which are so overcrowded that any way you try to approach the problem, there would be people that need to be removed from that place. And then, of course, it's a big problem, because who will move out, who will stay, and also how can we put back life into the central city? I think we need anchors, and we need initial projects that will mobilize investments. You cannot make money if you don't invest some money previously, and I think this is government has to realize that. First of all, we need to redo practically the whole infrastructure of the central city. Havana grew enormously at the beginning of the 20th century because it had a brand new infrastructure, sewers, roads that were paved, electric trams, phone network. So the city grew and expanded and became more affluent and attracted more investors. So it was a continuous cycle of vitality in the city. And now this is gone. So if you live in Central Havana, you don't have water supply, sewers are running into the streets. It's a bad place to live, but it could be a great place to live. You are close to the waterfront, you are close to the old commercial center, you are close to the historic core, and this is not also good for Central Havana. It's good for most of the central city. To the south, we had the beautiful neighborhoods, middle-class and lower-middle-class neighborhoods that could be renovated. But the thing is money, and we need to make people able to pay for that. And most of the Cubans right now are not able to take care of the place where they live. You know, 87% of the population in Havana pays no more rent.
Really?
They own the place, and they don't need to pay rent anymore. But the thing is that they own it. We own it in not completely. I cannot sell or buy. I can only use, or my children can inherit the place with some restrictions. So nobody really feels that owns the. And then you can own the place where you live, but who owns the building? This is also a problem. And there's also another problem. People, the reforms, urban reform law passed by the government, revolutionary government, was very good in the sense that evictions were stopped, rents were cut by half, people started to pay to the government instead of to the landlord, and with that money, in time, they became owners of the building, so they stopped paying. And this is okay. But what happened is that if you lived in a nice neighborhood, in a nice house, you became owner of a nice property, even if you cannot sell it or buy. But if you lived in a very bad neighborhood, in a bad house, you became the owner of a worthless piece. And you became attached for life to that place. So you can go to a shanty town, to a tenement, and see people who are physicians or engineers, whatever, living in a whole family in one room. Hmm. So this is also another, we are relating to another problem, which is what kind of incentives people have to move forward, to move upward. And if somebody carrying bags in a hotel can make more money than the best brain surgeon in Cuba. And this is something we have to face, and the government is very knows that, but they don't seem to find a way to deal with this. It's not fair. Hmm. The problem is that how to make the city work, how to make life more nice, and for people who are so poor that they don't care about anything else but thinking about the next meal. Hmm. How to? What will they have for dinner tonight? Mm. And then you cannot talk about beauty, about nice things to people who are so poor. And this is what's happening to the city. Mm. This is why the city has become more and more marginal. And at the same time, more and more ruralized. When you walk around Vedado, you will see it's very hard to see one block without a major distortion, like a junk garage built in front of the nice old facade. So now you don't see the beautiful classical Beaux-Arts facade, but you see the junk, which is right striking you in your face. And this is because people don't want to leave the cars in the streets because thieves can take the tires or the whole car. So it's easier to find to make police able to police the streets than to have the whole city filled with this junk, which, by the way, is built illegally because nobody can get legally the building materials or to make these cages. So the whole city is becoming caged. Everybody's trying to protect themselves from thieves. So the irony is that decent citizens are behind bars and criminals are walking freely in the streets. Hmm. And when I'm talking about criminals, of course, I need to say this is still a safe city by world standards.
I was going to say.
But not as it used to be 20 years ago.
Really?
For many years, for many decades, you could walk at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning in the most poor neighborhoods in Havana without any threat. Now you can get stolen, or somebody can steal your wallet or push you and take your camera or something. And this is a bad thing, and it's the result of poverty. Mm. Because 20 years ago, there was no big difference between people who have and people who didn't have. The difference, the gap in salaries was very small. And with the salary, you could not make a luxurious living, but you could make a decent living, everybody. And this has changed.
Mario Curla, let me ask, what if one thought of Miami and Havana as one city in two countries? There's so many connections of language and family and loyalty. What would they do together if they were free to do it?
Well, I think it will be a time when this will happen. The thing is that this could be good for Havana, but also could be very bad, because even with the best of intentions, people with a lot of money in Miami can destroy Havana by, for instance, destroying old buildings in order to be, make a nice... A tall condominium and make more money from that. Then what we would need is good investors that will care for more educated people who would appreciate fixing an old eclectic mansion from 1910 and turning into a very nice place to live in the middle of Vedado or in some other nice places. And so what we should need is these kind of people, people who would go beyond the conventional approach for luxury. What we should need is a very strong urban planning department that can stop bad projects and even move further by preparing dossier with good projects and say to any potential foreign investors, you want to do a business in Cuba? Okay, you can come and propose what you want to do. But if you choose from any of these projects we already have approved, you can start next Monday. And then the question comes, okay, if we open to foreign investors from Germany, Spain, and in the future from the U.S., shall we not also allow Cubans who live in the States to invest back in Cuba? And then, next question, if you allow Cubans who live in the States, why not allow Cubans who live here and never left Cuba, and they trusted this country? So it's there are questions that have to be answered.
Mario Coyola, in the meantime, we'll be thinking about ways to spend more time in this beautiful city of yours. Thank you very, very much for joining us on Open Source.
Well, thank you.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. There's more to come from Cuba in conversation with three American women getting a free first-class medical education in Cuba and a global vision of the world health crisis. And then there's the Cuban Revolution at 50. Join the extended conversation on Cuba at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining us.